Kimberly Atkins Store, and this is On Point. This hour, yet another mass shooting in this nation. At least 19 children and two teachers murdered by an 18-year-old gunman in a single elementary school classroom in a rural Texas town called Uvalde. "I'm sick and tired of it," the president said last night, echoing the exasperation of so many. The president also spoke last night of how no other country in the world experiences these kinds of mass shootings with such frequency. So this hour, we're asking, what will it take to find the political will to prevent these kinds of events from being a uniquely American experience? Joining me is Lee Drutman, senior fellow in the political reform program at the think tank New America. Welcome to On Point, Lee.
Well, it is a challenging day to process what's happened, Kimberly, but I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Yes, indeed it is. And also with us is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Kimberly. Hello, Lee.
Lee, I want to start with you. Just your reaction to the news less than 24 hours out of the worst school shooting in a decade, which is seems tragic in itself that just a decade ago there was another.
Yeah, I know. It is just so depressing and horrifying. And, you know, I'm a parent, and every parent who sends their kids to school and tells them they love them and gives them a hug. And yeah, it's just so depressing. And just also knowing that nothing is going to change. At least,
Jack, what about you? Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Jack, what about you? What are your reflections today?
Well, apropos Lee's point, nothing is going to change. David Axelrod, the former aide to President Obama, was on CNN this morning. He said he emailed a Democratic senator. What are the prospects, he asked him, for gun reform, for some change? The senator, the Democratic senator, emailed back, zero. So zero prospect, according to them.
Yeah. It seems that most people are reeling today. The people that I passed in the street yesterday were talking about this, and it is transcending all corners, including in basketball. Coach Steve Kerr of the Golden State Warriors held the usual pregame press conference after yesterday's school shooting, but last night's game wasn't the first thing on his mind.
Around 14 children were killed 400 miles from here. And a teacher. And in the last 10 days, we've had elderly Black people killed in a supermarket in Buffalo. We've had Asian churchgoers killed in Southern California. And now we have children murdered at school. When are we going to do something? I'm tired. I'm so tired of getting up here and offering condolences to the devastated families that are out there. I'm so tired of the moments of silence. Enough.
And the death toll, as we know, has been climbing even since then. Lee, what do you say to people who so often we see this repeated type of tragedy? And so often we do hear the thoughts and prayers and condolences and have moments of silence. And Coach Kerr is not the only American I know that is feeling very frustrated by that. What do you say to people who are feeling that frustration in this moment?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure anything I can say will help anybody who's processing this tragedy, you know, but I think it's, you know, to give yourself time to process it, and then, you know, there's work to do. You know, there's a political solution that's in plain sight, which is just to make it a lot harder to get guns and to ban the assault style rifles that are so often used in these mass shootings. You know, this is not exactly brain surgery here. We can look across different states in the U.S. and see that in states where it's harder to get guns, there are fewer gun deaths. In states where it's easier to get guns, there are more gun deaths. we can look around the world and note that gun deaths are remarkably high in the U.S. compared to everyone else, and gun ownership and ease of access to guns is uniquely high in the U.S. So if you want to save lives, you make it harder to get guns. The problem is that we have a political divide in which the Republican Party and Republican voters and Republican elected officials overwhelmingly believe that if you make it harder to get guns, somehow crime will go up. I mean, there is, despite the facts and mounds of evidence, there's just this, you know, fanatical flat earth belief that somehow if you make it harder to get guns, crime will go up. And there's this, you know, religious fanatical attachment to what is an extremely radical interpretation of the Second Amendment that the Supreme Court imposed on in the Heller decision, and is likely to even go further in an upcoming decision that says the Second Amendment gives everybody an individual right to, you know, basically get a gun very easily and not have to even, you know, show it. It's just this radical attachment to a radical vision of gun rights in this country that has no real basis in history.
Well, I wanted that you anticipated my next point, because I do want to get to the political divide in just a moment. But before you get to that division, it is, Jack, born out of what is very different from other countries, this idea that the Second Amendment is at the core of being American, that gun ownership is essential to being an American, and this fear that there is an attack on that right, that people are afraid that their guns are going to be taken away from them, when in actuality, when you look at what the courts have done in terms of the Second Amendment, I am not sure that there is a right in the Constitution that is more more heavily guarded and protected by court decisions than the Second Amendment. So, Jack, what do you owe that incongruence to? You go to other countries where gun ownership is high. They don't have that kind of mentality, and they don't have these types of mass shootings.
Well, I have no evidence for this, but I think this is intimately related to our program of the other day about the replacement theory. You know, shortly after, protests last year in 2020 over police violence, I was watching Tucker Carlson, and he said, "When they come for you," and he posited, you saw pictures of mobs, they were demonstrators, you know, trying to protest police killing of black people. But he said, "When they come for you, you need to be ready." I think driving a lot of this is a fear of when they come for you, that there's a kind of fear that the other, that the replacement people, that the people of color, the non-R sort, are going to come for me. So it's not just the government that's going to come for you and take away your guns. I think this is this paranoia and this fear is involved crucially in this, for many voters. After all, a third of Americans believe in this replacement theory. And if you believe in it, if you believe people are coming to take your place, to remove you from the electorate, as it were, well, that's only a dial of paranoia away from they're coming to kill me. And I think it's so tied in to the American curse of racism.
Well, we do know that the gun lobby has played a role in keeping gun control efforts from going through at the state and federal level. President Biden spoke about the deadly school shooting in Uvalde, Texas on Tuesday evening and called out the gun lobby specifically.
As a nation, we have to ask, when in God's name are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? When in God's name we do what we all know in our gut needs to be done? It's been 3,448 days, 10 years since I stood up at a high school in Connecticut, a grade school in Connecticut, where another gunman massacred 26 people, including 20 first graders at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Since then, there have been over 900 incidents of gunfires reported on school grounds. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Santa Fe High School in Texas. Oxford High School in Michigan. The list goes on, and the list grows when it includes mass shootings at places like movie theaters, houses of worship.
So, Lee, one of the things that makes this a uniquely American experience is the gun lobby.
Yes, there is a very powerful gun lobby in this country, the National Rifle Association being the most well-known, but there are many other gun lobby groups, and they have been historically very good at organizing grassroots pressure and organizing money in support of candidates, and both of those things have certainly had an effect. I think what is distinct in this moment in our political history is just how polarized the issue has become and how much Republicans and Democrats are just inhabiting different realities. You know, I think most Republicans would say, well, you know, it's a tragedy. It's awful that it happened. But, you know, if we take away people's guns, it will infringe on a basic constitutional right, and it will just create more crime. So that is the challenge.
So we are going to pause just for a moment. We are asking what it will take to find the political will to prevent mass shootings from being a uniquely American experience. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking about mass shootings in America. Here with me are Lee Drutman, Senior Fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America and author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. And also with us is Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. I want to play some sound from Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who spoke about the mass shooting at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas, yesterday.
When parents drop their kids off at school, they have every expectation to know that they're going to be able to pick their child up when that school day ends. And there are families who are in mourning right now, and the state of Texas is in mourning with them for the reality that these parents are not going to be able to pick up their children. Our job is multifold. First, to make sure we address exactly what happened at this crime scene, and then second, to make sure we take that information and do everything that is necessary to ensure that crime scenes like this are not going to be repeated in the future, and that we're going to be able to ensure the safety and security of our schools.
And Lee, another Texas politician, Senator Ted Cruz, had said in an interview that usually when something happens like this, politicians try to politicize it. And you responded in a tweet saying, "Politics is how we do collective action in modern society, Senator Cruz. To organize for change, we must politicize. Don't politicize means don't do collective action. Don't politicize means shut up and don't complain about injustice." Lee, what do you mean about the need to politicize at a moment like this?
Well, I mean, Senator Cruz is a politician, and you know, even saying don't politicize is actually a form of politicizing. But you know, I mean, politics is the way in which, you know, we respond to problems in our society. And if you don't do politics and you don't politicize things like this, you're never going to fix them, right? I mean, that's this is just a broader problem with how we talk about politics generally, is that somehow politics is seen as something that we just shouldn't do, and we should all just get along and agree and not try to fight for change. And that's sort of hierarchical totalitarian speak. So politics and politicizing is a fundamental feature of democracy, is that we argue about things and we organize people to vote and advocate and change things when we feel that there is injustice. I mean, it just drives me mad when people say we shouldn't politicize things or we shouldn't make this about politics, because politics is, you know what, about politics. I mean, yeah. It's just insane.
So originally today, we were going to come together to talk about something slightly different, and it was about how to be optimistic in a moment where everything seems to be going wrong. So Lee, I will start that part of our discussion here and say, ask you, how is it possible to possess political optimism at a time not only when we see attacks on our democracy and we see struggles for equal rights, but now also just see the most brutal reminder of the gun culture in our nation? Is there a place to find optimism here?
Well, Kimberly, I think there is, and I'm actually optimistic that there is, and I think for a somewhat counterintuitive reason, that the fact that we are having this conversation and that we are talking about the crisis of American democracy and that many of us are angry and engaged is actually the thing that gives me hope. Because if we weren't talking about the crisis of American democracy and we weren't angry and engaged, then I would be pessimistic. But it takes a recognition that we have a problem, that we are in a crisis, in order for us to start to actually organize and mobilize for a better future for all of us. And that's the thing that gives me optimism. When I look at history, it's precisely the moments in which everybody feels that the institutions are broken, that we are in crisis, that people begin to organize and mobilize and start doing the hard work of making the changes that are necessary for this ongoing experiment in collective self-governance that we are now in almost getting over two centuries. I think we're going towards our 250th anniversary as a country. I mean, this is a long-running experiment, but there have been moments in which it felt like the thing was going to fall apart. And Americans have this intense spirit of self-improvement that sometimes, actually always takes a crisis, but eventually I feel like we figure it out. And, it's a generational story, but it's in these moments in which it feels like everything is falling apart that we do start the hard work. And I feel like we're kind of getting to that turning point now.
Jack, what do you think? Is this a time where we can be optimistic?
I just think it's hard to be clear-eyed and optimistic. It's hard to look at the tendencies in the world, the currents in our politics, and be optimistic. We have never, as Liz Cheney pointed out at the Kennedy Library the other night, we have never had a situation where a presidential candidate and a party following him have essentially said, the hell with democracy. We're not going to abide by the rule of the people. She said that is a threat to our constitutional republic. Donald Trump and the Republicans who follow him are a threat to our constitutional republic. We have never had that before. Now, does that mean the next election is going to be, they're going to throw over the democracy? We don't know, but Cheney warns that's the danger. In the face of that danger, I don't see how you can say, well, let's hope for the best. It seems to me quixotic.
Lee, you wrote in the New York Times that eras of reform follow a general pattern. I want you to explain what you mean by that. To me, when I've been thinking about this over time, it always seems to me, when I look at history in America, that periods of progress are often followed by periods of regress, often in backlash to that progress. I think one example that's pretty clear is after the election of the first Black president in America, for example, you saw a rise in more white nationalistic groups and this idea that America is under some sort of threat because of that. Is that the right way of thinking about this, or is it reverse? Is it the difficult times that actually spurs the progress?
Well, I think it's both. History doesn't move in straight lines, but I think it does move in a kind of upward spiral in which there is progress followed by backlash, followed by progress, followed by backlash. And I mean, I think we've made tremendous progress in this country towards equality. If you think about where we started, only white men who owned property who were over the age of 25 could vote. And the idea that that was where we started, and where we are today, that's a long arc of progress. Now, has there been backsliding? Absolutely. But I think responding to Jack's comment about hope, I certainly think it's not hope alone, but there's a certain level of optimism that one has to have to engage and keep doing politics, because the alternative is just to give up. And we know that the forces of progress and justice and equality are never going to win if we give up, if we just say, well, that's just the way things are, and we'll just have to take it on the chin. Nothing changes when that happens. So I think it's important to be clear-eyed, and I'm not saying that things will change, but I'm saying the fact that so many people are engaged and angry and paying attention and feel that we are in a crisis is a precursor to reform. And if you look at previous eras of reform, there have been long periods of injustice that have built up pent-up demand, and then eventually the dam breaks, and we do big things. We have done big things in this country.
So on the issue of guns and gun violence and what to do to break the legislative logjam there, a listener, Sally Ho, called us from South Burlington, Vermont, about the latest school shooting and shared what she thought should be done.
I would like to suggest that the gun safety organizations come together and pool their resources to bring the surviving victims of all the shootings that have happened, adults, children, family members, whomever, to Washington to be a presence in the U.S. Senate in particular, so that the senators have to look them in the eye when they are making their decisions about what to do about this absurd situation.
So we talked about earlier, we heard from Coach Steve Kearse. He also said that it's about holding on to power, which is why lawmakers don't seem to do anything. Sally has this idea about how to stir our representatives into action. Jack, what do you think of that approach, and what do you think should be done?
Well, it's been tried when in 2010 or 11, after the Sandy Hook massacre, the gallery was empty, the Senate gallery, except for parents from Sandy Hook. They were there. They were watching when the Republicans filibustered with some rural state Democrats joining them, filibustered a bill that would have controlled guns, assault weapons, and so on. And it did no good. And when the bill was, when essentially the Senate shut down, they wouldn't even have a vote on it, a parent yelled out, "Shame! Shame on you!" Well, that happened before, and is it going to happen with parents from Texas, shouting shame? Will that move these frightened senators who, as you say, want to hold on to their power more than they want to save the lives of children? I don't know.
Speaking with Fox News's Tucker Carlson yesterday, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick called the shooting an act of, quote, pure evil.
Texas has done a lot of things after the Santa Fe shooting. Obviously, we have to do more. We have to harden these targets so no one can get in ever except through one entrance. Maybe that would help. Maybe that would stop someone. But it's really bigger than that, Tucker. We're a coarse society. We're a society that's just at each other's throats all the time. And we're better than this as a nation.
Lee, two questions for you. Do you think that's a part of the problem, the coarseness of our society? And has there been another period in history that we can draw parallels with to this current moment?
Well, I don't think it's the coarseness of our society. I think it's the ease of getting guns. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. Is there another period that has similarities? I think there are actually tremendous similarities between this period and the late Gilded Age, in which politics was incredibly polarized. There was a deep sense that institutions were failing. There were high levels of inequality. And there was sort of changes in the nature of life, in that people were moving to the cities, there were a growing number of immigrants, and there were big questions about what does it mean to be an American. And you know, that was a period in which we eventually figured out how to do some pretty big changes. We had the direct election of senators as a constitutional amendment, the introduction of the direct primary, which I think may have been a mistake. And you know, some other pretty significant political reforms. Ultimately, the right of women to vote was put into the U.S. Constitution. So I see a similar energy that you see the emergence of big social movements asking big questions. But there are challenges to that because there is a large portion of the population that sees itself as being threatened by these changes. And you have intense political partisan polarization, which means that Republicans just have a different view of the world, different set of facts. And you know, I don't think that Republican governors or politicians are being callous when they say that they are really sorry and they see evil in the world. I just think that there's something that doesn't connect, that it's actually the gun laws that protect people. There's like a missing, you know, circuit there that doesn't make that connection, because they are attached to this idea that the world is a scary place, it's an evil place, and the only way to protect yourself is to own a gun. And it's this level of frightened paranoia that I think is undermining their ability to see like basic facts, that if you regulate guns and make it harder for people to get guns, there are going to be fewer mass shootings. Something is just not connecting in those brains because they're exposed to a wholly different set of facts.
And Jack, on that point, to being exposed to a different set of facts, it's not just the lawmakers, it's members of the public. I mean, there are conspiracy theories, you know, one about Sandy Hook that's so awful, I won't repeat it. But even this idea that in a moment of crisis during the protests in 2020 or during the pandemic, we saw gun purchases go up based on this fear that people are coming for them, or that guns are going, Democrats are going to try to take people's guns away. That even in states like Hawaii and Massachusetts, which have the most restrictive gun laws, you can still buy a gun there. What do you think about that, Jack?
Yes, the fear is just seems so clear when you look at things like this. 2020, all-time record, 20 million guns sold. 2021, 18 million. The pandemic and the isolation people felt clearly reflected in the sense of, I'll give myself some security with my gun. And often it's my multiple guns. And, you know, the usual argument is self-defense. Well, in 2012, there were about 12,000 homicides by gun in America, and there were 259 justifiable homicides by gun, namely self-defense. 259. Mm-hmm. That's not many. You know, if that's the odds of self-defense, you're better without a gun.
Well, I'll hold you right there. We're talking about the political will needed to prevent mass shootings. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Akin-Store. We're talking about mass shootings in America. Here with me are Lee Drutman, senior fellow in the political reform program at New America, and author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. And also with us is Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst. So I want to start with sound from Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who took to the Senate floor yesterday, calling for his colleagues to finally do something on gun violence.
What are we doing? Just days after a shooter walked into a grocery store to gun down African-American patrons, we have another Sandy Hook on our hands. What are we doing? There have been more mass shootings than days in the year. Our kids are living in fear every single time they set foot in a classroom because they think they're going to be next. What are we doing? Why do you spend all this time running for the United States Senate? Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority, if your answer is that as this slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives, we do nothing? What are we doing? Why are you here?
I want to bring into the conversation now Daniel Webster. He is co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solution. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So we heard that plea from Senator Murphy yesterday. Since Sandy Hook, little has been done in Congress to curb gun violence. And if anything, on the state level, gun regulations have been rolled back. Is there any reason to believe this time could be different?
Well, one thing I want to say just on your point you just made, that yes, it's clear that Congress has not acted since the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. And yes, since that time, many states have weakened their gun laws. However, there has been change in response both to Sandy Hook, to the horrible shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. There have been almost 20 states now, I believe, that have so-called extreme risk protection laws that allow law enforcement and courts to take action to remove firearms. Individuals who appear to be threatening or planning acts of violence against others or themselves. Some states have expanded background checks. So there has been action in my own state of Maryland. There have been stronger regulations on gun dealers. We've passed handgun purchaser licensing laws, which actually my own research has shown is associated with reducing rates of fatal mass shootings. So some states have acted. We of course, I think everyone knows we live in a very divided country now, and we see acts of horrendous violence of this sort, and there are different reactions and mindsets. There's one reaction that says the only solution to this is more people with guns to, in essence, shoot it out with someone who wants to carry out an act of violence. And there's another group who sees the same horrible events and says, we need to do a better job of keeping guns from the hands of people who are too dangerous to have them. So that's what we face, and that's why we see movement in different directions. We see the same problem. We see different solutions to it.
From a listener on Twitter, Glenn Koenig says, political operatives in the U.S. Have become incredibly adept at gaining power by using fear and anger as their tool. It is incredibly hard to calm those fears once inflamed. Logic won't do it, that's for sure. If anything, this is a cultural problem. The guns are a mere symptom. Lee, does that track with what you have seen according to your research?
Well, I think it's hard to isolate those two things, because one of the reasons that people buy so many guns is because they are afraid. But another reason that people buy so many guns is because it's very easy to buy so many guns. I think that part of the challenge is that Democrats and Republicans see very different solutions to the problem. And we've highlighted them throughout this program because we've heard from both sides, and Democrats, I think, are right. They see the solution being just making it harder to get more guns, whereas Republicans tend to say the world is an evil, frightening place, and the only way to protect ourselves is by making sure that we are armed. And they think they're the ones who are being sensible here, and Democrats are just in a sort of fantasy world thinking that they can prevent people from owning guns, given how many guns are already out there. So this is a problem of hyper-partisan polarization at its core. It used to be a money problem. Now it's not really a money problem. It's a hyper-partisan polarization problem that is Democrats and Republicans are living in different worlds and see themselves as just fundamentally opposed to each other and relishing the fight more than actually wanting to solve the problem.
One Republican, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, after the shooting, shared with Fox News what he believes are the best steps toward preventing another horror like the Uvalde shooting.
We can't stop bad people from doing bad things. They're going to violate murder laws. They're not going to follow gun laws. I've never understood that argument. But we can harden these schools. We can create points of access that are difficult to get through. We can potentially arm and prepare and train teachers and other administrators to respond quickly.
So, Daniel, lots of organizations, including the Giffords Center, has pointed out that the good guy with a gun theory is largely a myth. There is not data supporting that. In fact, it's in less than 1% of crimes do people successfully defend themselves with guns. Why do you think this take that we hear from Republicans has such staying power given the lack of evidence?
That's a great question. I think that there are multiple parts to this. I think one is that it's easiest for us to view these events and this situation as in a very individualistic manner. So the lieutenant governor from Texas says there are bad people, and there's nothing we can do about bad people, in essence. I think that that's part of the issue, because the truth is that there are no more bad people in the United States than there are in some other places. It's just the set of conditions allow for the so-called bad people to act on their impulses and grievances in highly lethal ways. So I think that's sort of a fundamental challenge here, that we always just view this and we think, what's wrong with that individual who carried out that act? What I try to do in my line of work, because I'm in a school of public health, I try to make this a community or population context, and basically say, let's look at the data from that vantage point, and what creates the most safety for the most people. I think there's a challenge here also of people respond more to who is communicating whatever the point is as opposed to the actual point. So if you identify as a Republican and more conservative-leaning person, you will nod your head to the remarks from Lieutenant Governor from Texas. And if you're not, you may not. And so I think a challenge is to try to find ways to engage more people across a broad range of cultural and political backgrounds to get people in the more gear towards solutions and not just thinking of this as a bad person problem.
So, Jack, what about the role of courts here? I mean, courts are supposed to be independent arbiters of important legal questions. But we have seen with the Supreme Court after the 2008 decision in Heller, which established an individual right to have a handgun in your home, now the Supreme Court has signaled that in the weeks ahead, it could expand that to outside of the home, which would knock out the regulations that eight states with some of the most populous cities in our country have put on requiring people to demonstrate a need to carry a gun outside of their home. If the Supreme Court does roll that back, that will be seen as a victory by those who are against gun control efforts and a drawback to those who want more gun control efforts, further dividing the country. Do you see the courts as fueling this divide and making it harder to fix things?
Well, it seems so, and it may even be fueling political violence. One of the submissions to the court, amicus brief to the court, was by J. Michael Luttig, a conservative jurist, who pointed out that many of the rioters on January 6th said they left their guns home because there was a law in the District of Columbia that made carrying guns illegal. The court may strike that law down soon. And Luttig went on to say that essentially you can take a gun out of the home anywhere. He said such a broad right to carry would throw gasoline on the fires of our nation's future political conflicts. In other words, when there are demonstrations, when there are riots, this time the people will bring their guns. It is a frightening possibility that the incipient political violence that polls seem to show people feel may be armed by this Supreme Court decision.
Daniel, there are times we have also seen in the face of proposals for gun control, whether it's background check proposals or other things, while those are being debated, the number of gun sales in the country go up. What do you think it would take to get at the cultural aspect that we're talking about beyond just the law? Because the law only works when people embrace them and believe in them.
Right. Well, that's a great challenge. And we do see the minute there are, momentous acts of mass violence, and we begin to talk about gun regulations, more people buy guns. I think that we have to take a deep breath there, though, and recognize that, yes, there are some risks with more gun ownership, but most people who purchase guns are not going to represent a public safety threat. What I'm more concerned about is those increases in gun purchases that are completely sort of outside the regulatory environment, and allow for easy transferred to people who clearly have histories of violence or are planning acts of violence. So I think that we shouldn't, just because gun sales go up broadly, that's not necessarily the big issue. The big issue is, are policies set up in a manner that minimizes any public safety threat? But clearly there is a cultural challenge here, because as it was said earlier, you know, fear is a really powerful thing, and political and corporate actors understand that quite well. So typically, you know, we've had different spikes in violence over the years, and it's never one thing. There's a coalescing of strategies put together to lower violence, to then lower fears. And just as we now see things sort of escalating up, we can also escalate down. And that's why we typically see cycles of gun violence.
And Lee, on that point, and ways that we can try to see an escalation down, we have seen in recent years corporations speaking out more on social issues that they and their board members and their employees care about. Might there be an opportunity for something like that to happen? Are there places that we could look for and perhaps seek the optimism that you wrote about?
Well, I think if corporations are going to make a real contribution to the political change that we need on so many issues, they have to address the inequalities in our political system and the way in which our electoral institutions, the Senate, and also the use of single member districts in the House, overrepresents the most conservative rural parts of the country and allows for a kind of minoritarian rule in America, which is, you know, something that I think is incredibly anti-democratic and destructive to the legitimacy of our system, and the hyper-partisan polarization that makes everybody feel like, you know, they're under threat. And, you know, this is, when we talk about this culture of fear, the Republican Party operatives who run these campaign ads are just driving people's amygdala crazy, which of course leads people to buy all these guns and want to protect their right to own guns.
Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America and author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, the case for multi-party democracy in America. Thank you so much for joining us, Lee.
My pleasure to be with you.
Daniel Webster is co-director of Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Violence Solutions. Thank you for joining us, Daniel.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty is On Point's news analyst. Good to have you, Jack.
Thank you, Kimberly.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.